So the title I gave to this talk for tonight is called "It's called It All Comes Down to Right View." What I'm trying to point to is right view is where it begins, right? I mean, it's the first step on the Eightfold Path. And if we don't have right view, none of the other steps are going to work, basically. And so, but how do we do that? And first of all, I want to read a few little tidbits of things from various people about right view. This is Joseph Goldstein from his book in Mindfulness. Right view is the first important step on the path because it sets the direction. No matter how long or how difficult our journey may be, if we're heading in the right direction and we keep on going, we'll certainly reach the goal. If we don't know the right direction, then even with strong aspiration and efforts, we might wander for a long time and never reach our destination. The Buddha said that just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the rising sun, so is right view and right effort. Right view, the forerunner and precursor of the breakthrough to the Four Noble Truths. So right view is what sets up our deeper understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It's the first step. Then, something brief and pithy. This is Ryokan. It's a 17th century Zen poet and monk. And he says it quite. Ryokan is brief in his poetry. Buddha is your mind, and the way goes nowhere. Don't look for anything but this. If you point your cart north when you want to go south, how will you arrive? The importance, once again, of moving in right view lead, puts us in going in the right direction. And then Ajahn Sumedho, this is from his book, The Mind and the Way. The first of the eight factors in the path is right view, which develops from having seen and experienced cessation. To have right view requires that we be very mindful all the time. We must know that everything arises and passes away. It's not and is not self. And this must be a direct experience and insight. Right view is based on direct, insightful knowing. Not just thinking and believing in the concept. As long as you don't really know, but you just think you know, you will always be in a state of uncertainty and be confused. This is because intellectual knowing is based on symbols alone, not on direct experience of the truth. So what he's pointing to is, yes, right view is the beginning, but it's also, in a sense, the end. A long time ago, I wrote this article and I said something along the lines of the path isn't a straight line, it's a spiral, and we keep coming back. And so we start with right view, perhaps in the really in the simplest way, just like some sort of vague idea, yeah, like, yeah, this sort of makes sense, this Buddhist stuff, let's try it out. You know, that might be right view at the beginning. And then you know, as we practice and we practice all the other seven steps, we eventually get a little deeper. And then all of a sudden, there we are back at right view again, but now we have a little deeper understanding. And with that deeper understanding, our view becomes clearer. I mean, view is being able to see things clearly, right? Having right view. And we might go around that spiral many times. What Ajahn Sumedho just described is at the end, what we have. Actually have to do is know things. not in the intellectual sense at all, but it's some sort of insightful heart level. It's interesting that the very last thing in the Satipatthana Sutta, the things that we have to understand and practice, the very last thing is the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths, very beginning. Four Noble Truths, right at the end, spiraling around over and over and over again until we get to that place. It's an interesting way of looking at it. It's like the word path, always sort of implies going somewhere. And actually, we're just, as Rikon said, we're not going anywhere. We're just going around in circles, but we're going deeper into the teaching every time we go around that circle again. There's these classical images that people use of the path being like a mountain, right? And you all have to sort of go up to the top of the mountain. And I heard someone say, I forget exactly where I went, someone was giving a Dharma talk, and he said, no, actually, the Buddhist teachings is like a pit mine. You ever seen a giant pit mine, and the road sort of goes around and goes down a little deeper, it goes along a little deeper, and it keeps going down deeper and deeper and deeper until it gets to the bottom. Gets to the bottom of things, right? You're not going anywhere, you're just going around in circles. But you end up getting where you need to go. And that's what we're trying to do with this practice. So the question, of course, then becomes, how can we bring about right view? What is it that helps us clear up our view? And there's this sutta, and this is in from the Majjhima Nikaya, and Majjhima Nikaya is divided into sections, and this particular section is called is where the Buddha is speaking to Brahmins, and so Brahmins would come to the Buddha and ask for instruction, and he'd give all various kinds of instruction. This is called the Brahmins of Sala. So Sala is a village, the Buddha is there, the Brahmins have heard that the Buddha is coming, they go to him for instruction. And the Buddha said, basically, what you need to understand is to get right view, you have to abandon. It's a classic word in Buddhist teachings. Abandon is there, used a lot. It's like get rid of completely these 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. This is one of those classic lists. And he then goes into great detail about the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind. And I think this is a really interesting teaching because it sort of encompasses everything, right? It's like it covers all the various ideas. So the first, there's 10. There's three of body, four of speech, and three of mind, which I think interesting in and of itself. Speech is more important, has more numbers than the rest of them. I'll talk about that in a little bit. The ones of body. Killing, not harming living beings. So he's very precise here. He's not just like not harming, but not killing. He's very precise in this particular sutta. And then taking what is not offered, theft. Taking what is not offered, and misconduct in sensual pleasures. So these are like pretty obvious things. But what do they have to do with right view? And it's like, how could you possibly have right view and act in these ways? How could you possibly pretend you have right view and act in these ways? These things are all harmful to your practice. These will prevent you from practicing. Because what happens when we act in any of these ways? Killing, theft, and sensual misconduct is afterwards We're always going to get caught up in the, oh my God, what do people find out, and worry about this, and I shouldn't have done that, and worry and regret and fear are all going to be there, and all of these are going to disturb the mind. We can't possibly focus. So it's right view in the sense of we have to understand at the very beginning that we have to be careful not to go there, not to go to these places, to be conscious of leading, of being wholesome in our acts of body. These are like wholesome activities. So that's the ones of body. Then we have speech. Speech is it's a list of four. Sometimes you see five, sometimes you see three. You see, Buddha has different versions of this list I've seen in different places. But here it's like speech is, here's things we have to watch for, the unwholesome acts. Speaking falsehood, speaking maliciously, and speaking harshly, and gossip. Those are the four that he highlights in this particular sutta. Speaking falsehood, it seems obvious, but think about what it means. It means that we have to consciously be aware that when we get tempted to speak falsehood, it's usually because we have some idea that we're protecting someone, right? Oh, I won't tell them that because it'll upset them. Or I'll fudge the facts. Or maybe it has to do with my work or something. And if they found out that I messed up this experiment, then fire me. There's all kinds of reasons people tell falsehoods. But once again, you're going to be caught if you do this in that space of, well, what do people find out? They'll think I'm bad. And once again, if you never speak falsely, if you've ever been around someone who never tells falsehoods, it's quite powerful to be with these people because it's like you feel totally safe. You may not like some of the things they say, that's a separate issue, but it's like, I never have to go and go, she telling me that because he's trying to make me do something, but you never have to go to any of those places of worry about what that someone else is saying. It's such a relief to be around someone like this. Speaking maliciously, on my notes here, I say intentionally causing division amongst people. This is something that's endemic in our world right now. And it's something that, once again, if you speak maliciously, you say, if you badmouth someone, to use the vernacular, then you're going to worry about the fact that that person found out that you badmouth them, and then they're going to badmouth you. And so once again, all these things stir up the mind. They create these thought patterns that are going to be vibrating away in your mind and stopping your mind from becoming still and focused. Speaking harshly, being hurtful or offensive to other people. So this is, I'm interested that he separates this from malicious. The malicious is actually intentionally going out and causing harm. Speaking harshly is just being a kind of loud and obnoxious. It's a different degree or somehow. It's like just barking, feeling that to get your way you have to sort of just be belligerent. So there isn't sort of the malicious intent to harm others. It's just harmful because it wears people down. Especially the people who don't have a strong sense of self. If you're speaking harshly to them, their reaction is going to be really upsetting for them. And you're causing harm in the world to them and to yourself, because now you created this thing when you see the harm you created, and you go, "Oh my God, how could I have said that?" And now there's that wheel of guilt spinning yet again, right? And then gossip. And gossip is always harmful. And we gossip because it makes us feel important. I know something that you don't know, and I'm going to share it with you, but don't tell anybody. That's the vibe of gossip always. That sense of I'm making myself feel important and sound important, and I'm going to share this with you because you're special to me, right? And it's always about somebody else, and it harms that. It's always about harming that other person. And then, interestingly enough, what's missing on this list that you sometimes see when they talk about speech is speaking at the wrong time, and speaking when something that is totally useless, just like blathering. And you see this on some of the lists of the speaking at the wrong time. That's a really interesting one. It's like you have to tell someone something unpleasant, but you see that, and it's perfectly true, so you're not being dishonest or anything like that. But you just see that where they're at right now, where they're at in their energy space, what's going on in their life, whatever, to tell them this would just be overwhelming them. It would be like too much. And so you wait, and you, when they're in a calmer, clearer space, you let them tell them this instead. And this takes judgment. And it's like, you know, we have to be careful we don't get into this self-righteous, well, it's the truth, so they should know, right? You know, it's my duty to tell the truth all the time. Well, no, it isn't. It's your duty to tell your truth, but do it skillfully. Sometimes telling the truth at the wrong time can be very harmful, actually. And also, just one other little aspect of this. Sometimes outright lying might be very skillful. The example I like is that you're in a room with a bunch of people, and some guy bursts into the room with a gun in his hand and says, "Is George here?" And you know George is here, and you say, "Nope, I don't know any George." Outright untruth, because that's the skillful thing to do. So all of these things that we're looking at, we also have to look at them in context. We can't separate them from context. Sometimes that might be the most skillful thing to do, would be to just say no to something that isn't true at all, because it's going to cause less harm than creating the harm that it would if you said the truth. "Oh, yeah, George is right over there," right? No, I'm not gonna, probably not a good idea. Okay, so that's speech. And notice these are getting more subtle, right? We started with body, external stuff, then speech, which is, you know, how we interact with others. The primary way human beings interact with each other is through speech, whether it's written things written down, or things that, you know, like me talking here and you listening, or just hanging out talking to people. Right? That's how we communicate with each other more than anything else. We do it through art and music and other things as well, but our primary day-to-day way of communicating is always through speech, and that's why it has so many places we have to watch, because it's just, you know, by the time we're 1 year old, we already started speaking, right? And we'd speak until the last second, we're probably still speaking, maybe. And so it's like we have to be very conscious how harmful speech can be, both to the others and to ourselves. Okay. And then we come to unwholesome acts of mind. And this one, first one in the list is covetousness, which is hard to say. Covetousness. This is like wanting stuff. coveting, it's like, you shouldn't covet your neighbor's donkey, right? Or whatever, from the Old Testament, Ten Commandments stuff. But it's like, it's how we, because we want something, maybe that isn't ours, that leads us to doing unwholesome things in body, just like that. Or unwholesome, telling untruths so we can get something. There's relationship here, I guess is what I'm saying. And also, covetousness always means I want something I don't have right now. And what do? We spend all our time figuring out how to get it. Not very calming for the mind. Not making the mind go still at all. The opposite, as a matter of fact. Wanting, 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 wanting. It's never ending. And then ill will. Ill will is like that thoughts of ill will towards others, as opposed to thoughts of goodwill, metta, in other words. And ill will, ill will is on this list because it's also a place, a common place we go to that leads us to act and speak unskillfully. Just like covetousness does. It's what leads us to the other kinds of unwholesome acts of body and speech. And there's this wonderful little line from the Dhammapada, and he's talking about the ideas of how you see others and what creates ill will. And I think this is great. Focus not on the rudeness of others. Not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. Really simple instruction. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have or haven't done yourself. It's like that. There's a line in the Bible, I forget exactly where it's from, but it goes something like, you're always noticing the splinter in everybody else's eye, and you don't notice you've got a big plank in yours. It's like, take care of your stuff. Take care of yours. Instead of having thought, because it's so easy to get caught in thoughts of ill will, oh, that person isn't good enough or doesn't do this right, or blah, blah, blah. And all of that is there. What are we doing now? We're stirring up our minds again. And often those thoughts of ill will lead us to unwholesome acts of speech and body. And finally, the last thing on the list, when I first came across this, I was like, what's this doing here? The last thing on this list of the 10 unwholesome acts of body, speech, and mind is wrong view. Took me a while to get to the topic, right? But wrong view. Okay, and once again, I want to read a little tiny piece in the Dhammapada here. Right. This is verse 63. This is It's just, I think this is another brilliant little pithy. It's one of those things you put on your fridge, maybe. I don't know. A fool with a sense of his foolishness is, at least to that extent, wise. But a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. You can be acting foolishly, but at least be aware. That's what you're doing is foolish. That's actually, you're better off with that than just someone thinking yourself so wise and smart when actually you're not. Really deserves to be called the fool. The simplicity of this statement, I love this one too. So. So, why is wrong view the last thing on this list. Interesting thought, interesting question. I think it's that basically all of the other nine are all expressions of a wrong view. Wrong view contains all these other nine. Because if we have wrong view, then we act or speak or think in unwholesome ways. Wrong view is the thing that ties it all together. And I want to point out a couple more of these interrelationships, and because it's just stated as a list of 10 things, right? But actually, they're very interrelated. So, for instance, just a couple of examples I had written down here. Unwholesome acts of body will lead to unwholesome acts of speech. You'll lie to cover up. No, I didn't do that. I didn't. You'll lie to cover up wrongdoing. Gossiping and boasting about what you got, or your boss gossip and boast about what you got away with. Well, I got away with it. So it's cool. Right? Covetousness can lead directly to taking what isn't offered. Covetousness leads directly to, well, no one will notice if I take this one. Ill will can arise when you feel you have to protect yourself from other people who say you've acted or spoken in an improper manner. So if someone criticizes you for actually acting or speaking in unwholesome ways, and what do? You lead the harsh speech right away, like, who the hell are you to tell me, blah, 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 blah. You know, we've all been there, right? That reaction to being told that we've done something we know we shouldn't have done in the first place. But instead, to sort of protect ourselves, we react and burst out into harsh speech. Even to the point that, well, you do it too. How many times have you said that to someone? Or especially, see little kids doing this all the time. No, you do it too. And wrong view is the root of all the others. It's everybody does this. They are mean, rude to me, so it's okay for me to be mean and rude back. This is wrong view. Everybody does this. This is wrong view. So how we, and there are lots of patterns of thought like that that we don't question because they sort of become like the truth, you know. Folk literature or something in our mind somehow or other, they're like everybody does this as well. Then it must be okay because everybody does it, right? And it just turns into, you know, the blind leading the blind or something like that, which is not interesting. Thing in this sutta is that when the Buddha goes through this list this way, talking about what the unwholesome acts, and then he just flips them over. And for instance, the first one, instead of killing, it'd be not killing, harming living beings. Not taking what isn't offered. He makes the whole list again. It says, and this is how to be wholesome. This is, you've abandoned, by putting the negative in front of each of the ones of these. That means you've abandoned them. You've let them go. You've chosen consciously, mindfully, not to do these things. And that's the practice. These things aren't just like rules. These are all things we have to consciously practice. We have to think about it and go, oh, you know, you're just about to say something or do something and you go, oh wait, is this wholesome? Is this skillful? Yeah, sometimes I like the word skillful more than wholesome sometimes. Because skillful doesn't, you know, wholesome has a sort of a wagging finger attached to it sometimes. Whereas skillful is just like, I'm trying to learn how to be skillful in how I live in the world, because it affects affects my practice very directly. Also affects the world very directly, but it really affects my practice. So if I can be skillful around these issues, then I have a chance of having my mind go stiller more often. And so when we think about abandoning these things, most of these things, it's like, oh yeah, I can see how I could abandon that. But what about wrong view? How do you abandon wrong view? And that's something I want to spend the rest of the time talking about, actually. And there's this... This is from another sutta, a couple of suttas further on. And the idea basically is the way to abandon wrong view is to cultivate right view. To consciously make it a practice to cultivate right view. Cultivate means practice, act. It's an active act. It's not like it's not like think about right view. Occasionally when you have time. Cultivate means it's like it's an active process that we have to engage in all the time. And the Buddha in this other sutta has this one line that I always has stood out to me. Here, friend, right view is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. Right view is assisted by virtue, learning, discussion, serenity, and insight. So these five factors assist, lead towards more likely we'll have right view more often. And so now let's look at this list. Right? Virtue. Oh wait, I think we've talked about this a lot lately. But leading a virtuous life means that most of these things aren't, you know, that we're in this list of unwholesome acts of body and speech in particular, aren't going to happen. Because there's a virtue, leading a virtuous life is the opposite. It's the knots of all those things. Just by consciously making leading a virtuous life part of our practice, something we emphasize in our lives. Then the next one is learning. Learning. Oh, wait. Studying the Dhamma. That's what learning means here. Studying the Buddha's teachings and really understanding them, taking them in, and going, oh, yeah, that makes sense. We start to... But we only can do that if we actually put effort into studying the teachings. Whether it's the actual suttas like I'm inclined to do sometimes, or commentaries like, you know, Joseph's book Mindfulness is basically a giant commentary on this, you know, 400-page commentary on the Satipatthana Sutta. So studying commentaries, wise commentaries on the teachings, is just as useful as actually studying the teachings. Sometimes it's more useful because sometimes the teachings are sort of a little obscure, and when you read something like Joseph's book and you go, oh, that's what that meant. You know, so it's, but learning is a way to sort of get more clearly in the mind and heart what is skillful. And then discussion. So not only do we need to learn ourselves, but it's often very useful to hang out with other people. Oh, it's called Sangha, right? Where this is something you discuss. This is something you interact with each other and say, well, does this mean this or does this mean that? I thought of these two different ways, and someone says, well, I think, and then you get this sort of flow. And that's what arises out of having Sangha, having other people you share this practice with and share knowledge with and share interact with. And that once again clarifies our view of things, it clarifies our understanding of things. Then, serenity. Having time to actually be still. Not always rushing around constantly. Which is, of course, what our culture encourages us to do. And it might not be serenity as in sitting still. It might be serenity in having time to go for a walk in nature. Having time to just not have a schedule that's so jam-packed that you can't figure out how to get everything done in a day. And I see people go, yeah, that's familiar, right? But that's what we do. We because there's sort of like this virtue in our culture of like being really busy. If someone's really busy, it must be really important because they're so busy, right? And the flip side of that is, well, I'm so busy, I must be important. And we get caught in that way of thinking, that belief that busy is good. Busy is the danger that stops serenity from arising. It's the poison of serenity, the opposite of serenity, perhaps. And it's one thing we really have to work at, because it's just, plus there's so many great things we want to do, right? It's not like the things we're doing are a waste of time. They're useful, right? They're skillful. I'm happy. It's good things to do. I had a friend. He said once a year he'd write down all the things he thinks he has to do, and he'd try and put them in order of importance, and then he'd draw a line and chop off the bottom two and say, "Oh, not going to do those anymore." Eliminate stuff that way. He said it was great because it just gave him so much space to just be still. All he had to do was make this list, because we all have those lists in our head. Well, we got it, this, got it, that, blah, blah. And he just made lists and said, "Nope, those two got to go, so I can have time to not be busy." That serenity leads to being able to take in ways that the learning and discussion and actualize it in our practice and in our lives in general. Often we're so busy, I don't have time to be mindful, right? I'm too busy to be mindful. No. It's like busyness gets in the way of being mindful sometimes, because our mind is often, we're doing something, but our mind is already on the next one on the list. Oh, now once this is finished, then I can do that. I see this all the time when I'm going someplace to do something, like shopping. When I've got the shopping list, but I'm already in the store going, well, I got to make sure that those apples are that kind, and I'm in the car driving or I'm walking to someplace, but my mind is already there. Not very mindful. Not really paying attention to what's arising in the moment at all. And this is like what busyness causes. If I have serenity, when I get to the store, I'll figure it out then. I can just notice what's here right now. That's all I need to do. That's the difference between being too busy and having serenity. And finally, the last thing on this list, by cultivating right view, the last one on the list was insight. This is where all of this practice leads. All of this practice leads to this place where we start to go, at some point, something arises at the level of experiential awareness that we go, oh, that's what that Dharma talk was about. Oh, that's what that passage in that book that I sort of wondered about, that's what it actually means. And we start to have experiences of insight into seeing things as they really are, as opposed to how we think they are, or how we think they should be. Having experience of things as they really are is a description of what this practice is, in a sense. To know things as they really are. That's having insight into things. And insight leads to a clear understanding of things like impermanence and not self and suffering. These are the things we have to really have insight into to understand. And it only comes from having right view that leads us to the place where we have more time and focus to actually arise at, have insights arise. And be mindful enough to see that they've arisen. Sometimes we have insight, but we're so busy, our mind is so busy, we don't even see them. They fly by. Oh, well, this, nah, I don't have time to think about that now. Or whatever the thought is. Because we haven't laid the groundwork through leading a virtuous life, having learning, practicing, discussing, absorbing, and then being still enough to let things happen, and then insights arise. So this is how we cultivate right view. And as I said right at the beginning, this process is a spiral. We're not going to have, what Ajahn Sumedho described as complete right view at the beginning. We're going to have partial right view. We're going to have a little glimmer of right view, and then over time it deepens. We come around again and again in that spiral, and things get a little deeper. And that's how the practice works. It is in no sense is it a straight line. Of course, I have a little bit of poetry to finish this. This is from Dana Faulds. It's a poem called Let It Go. Let go of the ways you thought life would unfold, the holding of plans or dreams or expectations. Let it all go. Save your strength to swim with the tide. The choice to fight what is here before you now will only result in struggle, fear, and desperate attempts to flee from the very energy you long for. Let go. Let it all go and flow with the grace that washes through your days, whether you receive it gently or with all your quills raised to defend against invaders. Take this on faith. The mind may never find the explanations that it seeks. That's a really important line. The mind may never find the explanations that it seeks, but you will move forward nonetheless. Let go, and the wave's crest will carry you to unknown shores, beyond your own wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go, and find the place of rest and peace and certain transformation. Sounds like good advice to me.